Today is Transitions Tuesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Transitions Tuesday, we focus on all things related to the many different kinds of transitions we all have occasion to experience in our lives.
I am very pleased and honored to introduce to you Dr. Susan Heitler, the author of Prescriptions Without Pills for Relief from Depression, Anger, Anxiety, and More. Dr. Susan Heitler, thank you so much for joining us today on Mind Talk.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Now, Dr. Heitler, you are not a stranger to the writing of books or to writing in general. What are some of the other things that you've done?
I wrote originally for my profession, psychotherapists. That book was called From Conflict to Resolution. The idea was that people go to therapy for help resolving a problem in their life. We can call a problem a conflict. So I brought the information that was developing in the fields of law and business about conflict resolution to psychotherapy. Shall I tell you more, or
please,
is that enough for that?
No, I think you've written some very popular books, The Power of Two.
Yes. After I wrote for my profession, I turned my attention to what does the general public need. And above all, I like to see strong marriages. So The Power of Two, Secrets to a Strong and Loving Marriage, lists the curriculum of skills that people need to be successful as a husband or wife.
And I have to add to that that in early 2000, many listeners will remember anchor Harry Smith the CBS Early Show.
Mm-hmm.
And he introduced you, and I'm quoting, as the most influential person in my life, my therapist.
Yes, that was a great honor. I feel very appreciative to him.
Absolutely. And he clearly recommended that folks seek therapy when they're distressed. And he was also an advocate of premarital counseling when they are contemplating marriage. So I would say that you have a history that certainly dates back before early 2000s, but one in which you have been on this path and very, I would say, diligent, very passionate in helping people to help themselves. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement, and I give great credit to Harry Smith that when he had an opportunity to honor someone, he took that as an opportunity to tell his viewing public, get help. Before you get married, learn the skills. Once you're married, it's never too late. To give that kind of message beyond just a thank you to someone in his life, I thought was very impressive.
Absolutely. And inspiring, I know, for so many people. Certainly as a well-known person, but also as a male as well.
Absolutely. Because mental health or going to a therapist still has some stigma for some people. So his being so open and almost excited about what you can accomplish by seeing a therapist was a great contribution.
Well, as I said a little bit ago, I'm actually excited to have the opportunity to talk to you. So let's dive into Prescriptions Without Pills for Relief from Depression, Anger, Anxiety, and More. First of all, Prescriptions Without Pills. It's a great title. And
thank you.
And immediately there are going to be people who are going to say, no pills? I'm loving it. Let's take a look.
Okay. Good. I agree with you that there's a wave of skepticism about pills in all arenas, not just mental health, and especially in mental health now in this country.
Absolutely. And we'll talk a little bit in a moment about just the whole rise and sort of difficulties with the whole prescribing field. But let me start with something that you start your book with, which is an acknowledgement that emotions hurt. They can hurt.
Yes, yes. Actually, brain studies that have been done over the last decade or so have identified that when you feel emotionally distressed, emotionally in pain, the same area in your brain lights up as the area that would light up if you broke a bone.
Which is incredible. I mean, I think, you know, clinicians are kind of aware of that, certainly, but I think that's really important information for the general listening public to have. So if you're really feeling physical pain as a result of some emotional distress, that's not you making it up. It's not just all in your head. You really are feeling something.
Exactly. Physical pain, the pain is there for a purpose.
Mm. Talk about that, because you're very clear that these are alerts that we need to pay attention to.
Exactly. If you are walking along and take a fall and twist an ankle, your ankle hurts to tell you, hey, don't keep walking normally. No weight on me, please. Similarly, if you feel depressed, anxious, angry, or even if you're running off with addictive behaviors, those are signs that something is hurting, and the hurt comes from something real that needs your attention.
So the last thing that we need to do, which quite frankly many people have really been taught to do, is to ignore our emotions. The last thing we need to do.
Absolutely. Ignoring them, stuffing them so we get distracted, those don't help. And actually have long-term consequences.
Well, and you speak to the susceptibility of one's physical body to all kinds of diseases when they are dealing with chronic unhappiness and anxiety. Do you have a sense of what some of those illnesses might be that folks can be impacted upon physically as a result of their emotional dis-ease?
When you have an emotion, if you are not able to process it, that is to talk about it, to release some tears, or to get some new way of understanding the situation, if there hasn't been some flow of that negative energy out of your mental system, that energy stays there, and it gets stored in your body. Interestingly, not necessarily in your brain, it goes to an organ, like your lungs or your heart or your stomach. It goes to a gland, or it can even land in a muscle or in a bone. It gets stored there. Now, the reason I feel very confident saying that is I've worked over the last 5 years with an energy therapist who has techniques for pinpointing exactly where in the body that emotion is stored. Often, once we've released the emotion by identifying the long-ago situation and talking about it for a few minutes, not a long time, just a few minutes, once that negative emotion is released, whatever pain or dysfunction was in that organ goes away. So somebody who had, for instance, terrible neck pain, they discuss the incident, release it, and all of a sudden their neck just is fine. They can turn to the left, to the right, total freedom of movement and no pain.
You know, we've done a couple of programs here on Mind Talk having to do with energy therapy, but give those listening who may not be clear about what that actually means, what's a thumbnail description of what energy therapy actually is?
Well, the core idea is that our bodies store memories as energy. Now, beyond that, and if you want to therefore release an old, the negative feelings associated or energy associated with an old memory, you can keep the memory but release the negative emotion. And to do that, there's a broad range of techniques. The particular technique that we work with, actually we work with 20 or so different techniques, but one of the main ones is called emotion code. I won't explain it. Because people can Google emotion code and see it. It's a very speeded up version of psychoanalysis. There's techniques actually invented by a chiropractor, Bradley Nelson, for immediately, like within a minute, accessing what the feeling is that's been bothering you, when it occurred, what the incident was that triggered that feeling, And then in a few minutes, you release it.
And we've actually had Dr. Nelson on Mind Talk.
Oh, you're kidding.
No,
I'm very
impressed.
I'm thrilled. He is credible. Now, the medical establishment gets very wary of a chiropractor, never mind the psychological establishment, saying a chiropractor, energy.
Exactly.
So I might have been prone to do that, except that after 5 years of working with a practitioner in my office with my clients and seeing client after client experience such relief, I'm converted. I'm a believer.
And, you know, you're right. I mean, when I first actually saw his book and first began to talk to him, I thought, okay. But but you're right. I mean, it's just extraordinary. All right, let's go back to prescriptions without pills. You refer to the five levels of the five L's of effective therapy. What are you talking about?
Oh, my goodness. I'll have to look back in the book to see what I was thinking of then, because I don't remember what stood for L. In effective therapy, though, my guess one of those L's is learning.
Yes.
You want to leave each session feeling like you've learned something. A second L, which may or may not be the L's I put in the book, is you want to feel an increase in loving feelings, better toward yourself, feel better towards the other people in your life. You want to clear up the blockages that you've had to being able to really appreciate and enjoy the people in your life and your own life.
And
that's two L's. Do you have the book there? Maybe you'll help me out.
Well, I'm going to help you out because the first one that I see is label, and you talk about the importance of diagnostic clarity as the first step of treatment.
Good. Well, it's very funny to be an author because sometimes we forget what we wrote way back when we wrote those early chapters, and now that you say it, my reaction is right on.
That lady was really smart when she wrote that.
Right. So, yes, if you don't have a name for something, if you don't know exactly what it is, it's pretty hard to come up with an appropriate treatment. That's true for medical issues. That's true for problems in a business. It's also true for psychological issues. So I do begin in the book in each chapter on depression, the chapter on anxiety, et cetera, with really explaining that phenomenon so that people can label both on the visible level, oh, yes, that's what I've been seeing happening in myself, and also on the underlying level, oh, yes, that must be what triggered that set of reactions that I've been seeing in myself. So, for instance, in depression, if I've been low energy, I feel like there's a dark cloud over me. Oh, there's a name for that. And there are causes.
And so often for folks, just getting a label that they can understand is really helpful because otherwise it's just so huge you have no idea.
Well, somebody along that line said to me recently, well, I've been feeling down. I get these waves, they usually last around 2 or 3 days, of just feeling gray, kind of hopeless, discouraged. Is that depression or is depression this really awful thing? Well, all of these phenomena, just like medical issues, exist on a continuum. So you can have slight sniffles or you can have a major cold that develops into pneumonia. The same with depression, anxiety, anger. You can have a little tendency to anger or you can have a major problem with anger that impacts all your relationships.
So clearly when you have a sense of what it is you're working on, then you can figure out the work that you need to do. And number two under the five L's of effective therapy. You should read this Dr. Heitler's book.
It's
an excellent book. She's
okay.
Clarify and mitigate the impacts of earlier life experiences on your current emotional reactions. What does that mean?
Well, there's a very interesting phenomenon. I think we all understand now the word template. We have a template for writing reports, a format, a set of questions that, or a set of reactions we're supposed to have to a certain situation. Well, we develop templates of response as we have strong experiences and even repeated experiences that aren't that emotionally strong growing up. So, for instance, if when you made a mistake, somebody said to you, "That was so stupid," then you develop a template of response to mistakes, which is to be self-critical.
Indeed. So learning more about how earlier life experiences, what they were, and how they impacted you is an important part of this work. And then you talk about after you label, after you look back, then you look at what is right now, looking at current concerns.
So you raise a very important technical aspect of the conduct of psychotherapy. Originally, the original psychoanalysis said, let's spend 5 years just looking back.
Right.
Now, what more modern uses of that same idea do is say, let's see what's going on in your current life. If there's a reaction that seems to be from an old template because your reaction now doesn't seem serviceable for you, it's too emotionally intense or it doesn't get you the results you want, such as blaming yourself when you've made a mistake, then we look at that specific reaction and dive down like a surface dive in swimming where you just bend at the waist and go straight down to the bottom, pick up the exact formation moment and come back up. Oh, so we don't have to swim around for 5 years on the bottom of the sea of memories.
Which is actually quite a relief for many people. And you're right. I mean, it certainly is, at least in my view, a lot more helpful than spending all your time looking at history and staying right there in history. Okay.
Exactly. Would you like an example?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm thinking of a therapy session I did with someone last week. It was the first time I had seen him. He said he's had a lifelong problem with anxiety. Lately, it's been coming up in more frequent and more intense ways. He gave me an example of how he has anxious thoughts about almost anything, but in this case, they were about his daughter.
Okay.
We talked a little about his fears of not being a good enough parent for his daughter, and I said, close your eyes and allow images to come up of some time earlier in your life when either you or someone you knew expressed fears about parenting. He looked confused for a moment and sat with it. Then he got the funniest facial expression, like almost joy. He said, oh, that's it. That's my mother and my father. They were both, in different ways, always anxious about me and about whether they were doing the right thing for me. So isn't that what all parents do?
Absolutely.
Well, I said to him, not absolutely. In fact, most parents just enjoy themselves. They parent. Sure, they think, gee, could I do it better this way or that way. They don't parent with a constant sense of anxiety.
Yes.
So believe it or not, he could have left at that point, 10 minutes into the session. He felt, as he described it, using his hands, like someone had just reached over to his shoulders and lifted up this huge burden he'd been carrying around for years.
And, you know, what it speaks to, certainly for those who are parents or supervisors or anyone, if you're walking around with sort of this vat of anxiety in which you live, you're going to share that with the people around you, whether you're aware of it or not. And maybe
exactly.
That's not a good thing for anybody.
I'm sure that this fellow, let's give him a name, let's call him Dan.
Okay.
Dan's parents were probably lovely people who cared deeply for him and wanted only the best for him. They were probably doing parenting with this heavy-duty anxiety the same way their parents had done it. So these things are passed down inadvertently from generation to generation. They're very communicable.
Absolutely. Dr. Heitler, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to finish taking a look at the 5 L's of effective therapy. We've only got 2 more to go. Folks,
okay.
This is Pamela Brewer, and you're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be right back. Dr. Heitler, as we look at the 5 L's, we've talked about the freeing and the healthy and the useful aspects of labeling. We've talked
Yes.
about looking back. We've talked about looking at what is right now. So now let's talk about looking ahead. What is the value
Yes.
of that?
Well, one way to look at what's going on now that you're doing that seems problematic is to look at it in the best possible light in terms of what it's intended to accomplish. That is, if you look at your seemingly self-defeated behaviors in a positive, forward-looking light, what am I trying to accomplish here? Oh, surprise, there's some good goal. I'll give you an example. If you look at the constant anxiety that Dan was feeling that we talked about first segment,
yes.
If he looks at that in the best possible light, he thinks that being constantly anxious is going to help him to be always a better parent. Now, there's a grain of truth in that, but mostly it's a mistaken idea. He can be motivated to keep learning new parenting skills without carrying that burden of anxiety. So when you look forward by looking at the best in the best possible light at what you're doing and what it's meant to accomplish, then you can figure out a better way to get to that destination.
And in figuring out that better way, I think we have now bumped up against the 5th L of effective therapy, which is learning new skills.
Absolutely. Sometimes we can figure out a better way to get there just with what we know in our current repertoire. Sometimes we need to learn something new. For example, I'm thinking of someone who's had a long-term problem with anger that contaminates his family. He gets mad too often at his kids. He gets mad too often at his wife. And sometimes he gets mad at people at work, which has not endeared him to his employees. So what's the skills he needs? One core skill that was quite new to him was the notion that when something goes wrong, he needs to look at himself, not at other people. He needs to look at what can I do differently instead of chastising other people.
And that could be quite a turning point for many, many, many people.
Absolutely. The tendency to hyper-focus on others, telling them what to do, feeling like it's your job to be the giant puppeteer, it's really quite burdensome and it sets you up to be frequently angry because other people do not necessarily agree to be your puppets.
And it sets you up for failure.
Absolutely. Because as they defy you, as they resist you, you get into more and more anger, and that can go down the road of divorce or job loss or an unhappy organization. Absolutely, that's the road to failure.
Let's talk a little bit about medication. Now, clearly, the name of your book is Prescriptions Without Pills. And when we
Right.
think about prescriptions, we think about pills.
Right.
So you're not saying that pills are hands down a bad option. What are you saying about the use of medication?
Yes. If you think of fire, fire can burn down a house, and fire also can help to keep you warm. Pills are the same. Used appropriately, carefully, in the right circumstances, they make a massive difference. I, for instance, had very severe adult-onset asthma, and I was so thankful for the pills that in a few days brought me from the brink of death to totally normal health. So pills sometimes, including for psychological issues like depression or anxiety, can be a huge help. They're just vastly overprescribed.
And, you know, the overprescription, I don't know how you feel about this, but I kind of lay that at the door of the insurers, because it seems to me that they're looking for the fastest, quote-unquote, symptom reduction, fastest, cheapest symptom reduction that they can possibly find.
Well, that can be one factor. I think that we need to expand the pie of causality here.
Okay.
Yes. If you look at TV advertisements, the pharmaceutical ads train people, teach people, if you feel better, take a pill. If you feel badly, take a pill.
Right.
So the whole advertising and pharmaceutical industry is an issue. There's another problem, unfortunately, with pharmaceutical industry, which is they're involved in a lot of the research, and there's been a track record of suppressing studies that show that the pills don't work, antidepressants, for instance, or suppressing studies that show how addictive anti-anxiety medications are, and instead showing the doctors and publishing in the journals just the research studies that show efficacy.
And so here we are looking to the quote-unquote experts in the field who sometimes are actively collaborating to keep us from the full information that we need.
Yes. Now, if you look at your average doctor, he's relying on what he's reading in his medical journals.
Right.
And I give him or her a lot of credit for keeping up on the latest journal articles. At the same time, what he or she may not realize is how the information has been doctored before it got there by suppressing certain information and also running studies. Oh, I'll give you another example that disturbs me. When studies are done comparing medication with energy therapies, unfortunately,
yes,
the people who run the studies control the dosages. So they give too little of the energy therapy, or they have insufficiently trained practitioners doing the energy therapy. So, of course, it comes out, oh, that energy therapy was not effective. Take a pill instead.
There are all kinds of things that we certainly need to be aware of. And, you know, just the idea of engaging in critical thinking throughout your life, almost no matter what it is, I think our conversation right now really underscores the need for that.
Yes, particularly when we see studies that have numbers, statistics. It looks very convincing when, oh, statistically, the people who took the pills did better. It's not necessarily so. In fact, when you look in more detail at studies, for instance, of antidepressant medications, those who took a placebo did almost as well, virtually the same level of recovery as the people who take the pills. Now, that doesn't mean in every instance pills
right.
don't work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another problem with statistics. They just talk in general about the group. For any given person, they may be a very good responder to the medication, or they may be a non-responder. So I'm thinking of a client of mine for whom there was a lot of relief just from psychotherapy. At the same time, he still had this underlying sense of a dark cloud that just never left him. It was maybe 10% of what he had when he first came in. So on the one hand, he felt good. He cleaned up a lot, and he could go to work, and he was happy with his kids. But that nagging negative feeling was still there. He added medication. It went away within a couple of days.
Within a couple of days? Wow.
Right.
That's pretty extraordinary.
Yes. Yeah, so now, again, this was just the remaining sludge of depression that
sure.
was there.
I gotcha.
He was still very happy that he had done this psychotherapy, because what psychotherapy does that pills can't do is one of those L's, learning. He learned skills for interacting with his wife and with people at work that radically shifted his propensity for depression. Do you want me to explain those skills?
Absolutely.
Depression occurs when we give up on something we want. It's a drop in power level. Actually, when your serotonin drops, you feel less powerful. So what he needed to learn was skills for advocating for for himself, for being able to add what he wants in a collaborative way when there's a decision to be made. The decision could be a small one, like what restaurant to go to with his family, or a large one, like about what his role would be in an upcoming project. But his pattern had been to give up on speaking up about what he wanted, or else to get mad and start criticizing other people. Both of those patterns are very self-defeating. When he learned collaborative problem solving and became comfortable with saying, well, my concern is, blah, 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 I would like to, blah, 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 that skill set gave him a way to advocate for himself, which gave him more internal feelings of power, which made him depression resistant.
And certainly he winds up feeling better about himself and experiencing himself in a more full, healthier fashion.
Exactly. It even leads to more money, because he was more effective at work. He actually ended up changing jobs as a result of that, and his current job probably pays double what the prior job, and has growth potential that the other prior job didn't have.
Not bad.
Yes. That's when we were talking before about looking ahead. That's another example of how therapy gives you skills for having a better future.
Before we go completely away from the medication discussion, which I want to, there are some diagnoses that I believe you believe really do indicate the need for medication.
Absolutely. The two that come to mind right away are, number one, ADD or ADHD. That's attention deficit disorders, where your mind, instead of staying focused on what you need to be doing at the time, gets more bouncy. One of my clients gave a wonderful description. He said, oh my goodness, this was an adult who had just discovered that he had ADD. Actually, he discovered it from doing an online free test for ADD, which I recommend to all the listeners if they think they may have a bouncy mind. He said, I've been going through life pushing a shopping cart that has one wheel missing, or blocked or something. So I'm constantly, I start going forward and I go left. I start going forward, I go right. It's so hard to just keep going in a straight line. As soon as I started taking the medication, all four wheels were on the cart.
That's a great description.
Yes, I give them a lot of credit.
All right, so ADD, ADHD.
That's one syndrome where medication makes a massive difference.
Okay.
And by the way, ADD can wreak havoc on a marriage and on job success, because when people have ADD, they say, oh yes, I'll do X, and they're glad to pick up the kids from school at 3 o'clock. Only because their mind isn't staying focused, 2:45 something else came up, and all of a sudden 3:30, oh my goodness, I forgot to go get the kids. So that gets repeated again and again, the scenarios of unreliability, and wreaks havoc in the relationship between husband and wife.
Are there any other illnesses that, from your perspective, really could benefit from medication?
Yes. Thank you for keeping me on that question. Schizophrenia is another one, or any psychosis.
Okay.
Yes. So if you... A psychosis is an illness where someone looking at that person would say, he's crazy, or that's loony. That is, what the person is seeing doesn't correspond to the reality that everybody else is seeing. Now, sometimes somebody just has clear vision, and their different perception is not crazy. It's just looking at different data or seeing things very clearly, more clearly than other people. Generally, though, when people are saying things that just don't make sense or are extremely paranoid, those are forms of either psychosis or schizophrenia. If someone's hearing voices, seeing things that are not there, medication.
Okay. Hands down.
Yes.
Okay. Let's move from prescription medication to the natural medication that you talk about in your book. Let's look at the 8 natural antidepressants. I'll help you out if you don't have the book in front of you.
Okay. Good.
Attitude is
okay,
number
when
one.
When people are depressed, one antidote to depression is to get mad, actually. You won't be happy, but you won't be depressed if you're angry. So aggression is a natural antidote, not a helpful one. I use aggression as a way to remember, with the first letters, the set of very helpful natural antidotes. So shall we start with A?
I think that's a good plan.
Okay. Let me find my list of them. Page 34. Okay. So the A in aggression stands for attitude. If you are taking a victim stance, you'll feel hopeless and not do anything to change your situation. It's all someone else's fault. If, by contrast, you change your attitude and start saying, wait, what could I do to be more effective in this situation? The depression actually begins to lift. That's A.
Okay. And again, you know, just the awareness that as individuals, we actually can make a difference in our own lives, in the way that we feel and sort of our own walk, is so powerful. And so many people lose sight of that, particularly when they're feeling depressed.
Absolutely. And sometimes what we have to change is not necessarily an action. It's just the way we think about something, our attitude, again, toward the problem. So, for instance, recently I had a problem with my publisher where I realized, oh no, there's a mistake on the back cover and they're just about to go to print. Well, if my attitude toward them or toward me or toward the book was of hopelessness, there's nothing I can do, this is so awful, people will look at the back cover and see the mistake and say, oh, that book's shoddy. And so that's an attitude of victim and hopelessness, and isn't this terrible? So if instead I say, wait, mistakes are for learning, and mistakes, when you learn from them, lead to something better. So what can I do with this mistake, this bad thing that happened, to turn it into a blessing? Okay, once I switched attitudes like that, I realized there's actually 5 things that I would like to see different on the front, back covers and the spine, all of which they print together. So maybe I'll call my publisher and say, look, since we have this one mistake, let's turn it to our advantage and clean up all 5 problems. They said yes. The book cover will be much better.
Well, there you have it. And you know, certainly with attitude, it allows you, when you shift your attitude, it allows you to let in the creativity that is very often naturally there, but we sometimes keep hidden. Dr. Heitler,
absolutely.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, let's take a look at gratitude.
Great.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. I am having a conversation with Dr. Susan Heitler. We will return in just a moment. Dr. Heitler, let's talk about gratitude and giving as two of the natural antidepressants you discuss in your book, Prescriptions Without Pills.
Great. We're following down on aggression. We did A for attitude. Now comes AGG, gratitude and giving. So I tell a story in Prescriptions Without Pills of a woman who came in very distressed, depressed, anxious, angry, the whole set. Her mother had just died. That in itself was very distressing. So she was grieving. At the same time, her sister was in devious ways stealing all the inheritance. So she was doubly, triply, quadruply distressed. We did talk practically about some measures she could take to protect herself. She was still feeling very down. What made a difference was I asked her to close her eyes. If you had to look at this situation from the perspective of gratitude, what do you feel thankful for? Her answer really impressed me. She said, you know, I look back on what a wonderful mother I had. I feel so, makes me cry to think about it. I feel so thankful to have enjoyed her blessings. And you know, as I look back, I see that my sister, who's always had a mean and selfish streak, never really got the blessing of enjoying and appreciating our mom. What a special woman she was, and I will treasure that memory and feel gratitude for all the years she gave me.
What a beautiful skill that she shared with you. What a beautiful perspective and a beautiful memory.
Yes. Giving. Shall we talk about giving?
Let's talk about giving.
Okay, the second G is giving. There is a psychologist who taught a hugely popular course at Harvard, Tal Ben-Shahar. And he and other psychologists who do what's called positive psychology looked at what makes people really happy. So they did a study with the students in the class. Go out and find activities that make you really happy. So some went out and did skydiving, and some did hanging out with their friends. Some got drunk. Of all the things that made people happy, and they scored how much happiness, those who did something that involved giving experienced the most and the kind of deepest and long-lasting joy. If you just give a dollar bill to somebody who's on the street and needs food for dinner, even that little bit of financial giving can give you a jolt of mini joy. If beyond that, you're doing activities in your life that involve giving to others, hanging out with some kids and playing with them so that they have the time and attention of a grown-up, for instance. All kinds of ways one can be giving. That act of giving is an antidote to depression and a stimulant for well-being.
Let's skip through the list to sleep and sunshine. They kind of seem to be the opposite of each other. What's that about?
Yes. Well, first, if aggression had three S's, I would add one more S. Sleep, sunshine, and sex all induce positive feelings. So your body, in fact, has needs. So if you don't attend to the basic sleep needs of your body, you're inadvertently setting yourself up to feel more brittle, more anxious, more quick to anger, and more depressed. When you're sleeping, your body is digesting the day's experiences. It's rejuvenating all the organs in your body. It does a lot of physical and emotional healing. So just like your car needs to go in for oil change and checkup every X number of months, every X number of hours, your body really needs Y number of hours of sleep.
All right, now you've added another S to this. So sleep, sex, right, and sunshine. What's the sex?
So,
what's the sunshine?
Sex was the third one. We'll do sunshine first.
Okay.
Just walk outside in the sun, do a little experiment, and notice what a pick-me-up it is. Now, that doesn't mean you have to lie for 3 hours in the sunshine and get a sunburn and skin cancer. It does mean that the more sunshine, the more brightness physically in your life, the better. It's also true that the more sunshine emotionally you give and you receive, the happier you are. Emotional sunshine is, oh, gee, I like that. Or so enthusiasm, appreciation, smiles, laughter, those are forms of emotional sunshine. So indoors and out, sunshine. The third X, sex, it's an upper.
Okay. That's pretty simple. That's pretty clear.
Yes.
All right, so now that we...
And then, well, I will make it a little more complex. Sex plus a positive relationship makes the fullest upper, because sexual connecting has both emotional and physiological sides. So when somebody has been sexually active with someone they love, that those moments of intimacy and playfulness and connection post-sexual connecting are as invigorating and augmenting of joy as the actual sexual endorphins or oxytocin or sexual chemistry.
So clearly we're not talking about sex for sex sake, but sex in connection with a rewarding relationship, one that feeds you.
Well, that's for sure the most augmenting of good feelings.
Okay. What about this N in aggression? What about newness?
So newness, ever gone shopping, bought something new, well, you didn't really need it, but you just were happy? That's newness. That's part of what makes shopping sometimes addictive. Newness can mean, though, for instance, the other day, my husband and I went walking in a section of Denver that we hadn't been to for a long time. That was fun. Anything new.
So
new things, new people, new activities. That's why people go on vacations.
Are vacations important?
Well, they certainly give a boost. They reduce stress and they increase well-being, assuming you're doing the vacation in a place that you like, you feel safe, you're doing activities you enjoy, you're with people you love or meeting new people. So absolutely, they can be a real positive, as they say, shot in the arm.
Fair enough. As you and I continue our conversation about prescriptions without pills, you clearly have identified experiences for people that can often feel pretty big: depression, anger, anxiety. Let's turn our attention for a bit to the costs of anger, and they are great and they are many.
Yes. How do you feel when someone is angry at you? No doubt it's not a pleasant feeling, but when people are angry, they don't think about the feelings of the other person. They're just hyper-focused on getting what they want. That short-term perspective can make for long-term damage.
How so?
So anger enables people to win the battle and lose the war.
Well, but now people do get angry. I mean, there are angering things that happen in the world.
Yes.
So then what
do we do with
that?
Is, yes, once you feel angry, what are your options? So I say in prescriptions without pills, anger is a stop sign. As soon as you feel anger rising within you, stop. Step back. Maybe even step out of the room if you need to. Take the pot off the stove, to mix metaphors a little here. Stop in order to look around. Because what do you do at a stop sign? You stop and look both ways, right?
Right, absolutely.
Look around, see what the potential problem might be. If it's all clear, then you can go ahead. If you see a problem, then you think, what shall I do about that? So if there's a truck heading your way, you don't pick up the stop sign and clobber the truck with it. You stop and wait, or in the case of a truck, it's pretty simple. You wait until it goes by, and then you continue on your way. In the case of interactions, let's say with someone at work, let's say you're angry at a coworker. If you're annoyed because that person is doing something that's interfering with your getting your work done, then you stop and you think, what might be a constructive way to handle that?
Now, that stopping is the best of all possible worlds. As I think about the world in which we live today, and I think about previous, oh, you name it, political campaigns, news stories, you know, what happened last week down the block around the corner, there seems to be so much anger, and stopping, unfortunately, is the last thing that folks do. The immediate thing seems to be to lash out.
Yes. We all have some animal programming within us, some fight or flight. So anger mobilizes us to fight, to leap out and attack. Unfortunately, attacking is not necessarily the most effective. Again, we may win the battle but lose the war. So if we stop and think what's a more effective way to get what we want, then we can figure out how to discuss the problem with that person, or how to go around and talk with someone else in order to solve the problem, or any number, infinite number of possible solutions. It's the point of stopping is not to just stay stopped, but rather to think of an approach to the problem that will yield problem solving, a real solution, preferably a win-win solution that works for other people involved and also for you.
So that sounds like a level of seasoning, if you will, a level of maturity that allows
exactly.
you to stop and consider versus not stop and try to beat somebody in the head, for example.
Exactly. It's funny you should mention maturity. I wrote a recent Psychology Today blog post on childishness. One characteristic of young children is they're impulsive. As soon as they feel mad, they strike out and punch someone verbally or physically. Adults, by contrast, can pause. They listen to their anger. They don't ignore it. They find a way to talk. As parents say, use your words to talk about what's going on and to talk collaboratively. They don't immediately shift into adversarial mode. That's a hallmark of maturity. In fact, if you take that one step further, when people are angry, they can't take in new information, and they can't really pause to understand the other person's perspective. To find good solutions, win-win solutions to problems, you need to be able to do that. So the hallmark of maturity is that ability to find solutions that are responsive to your concerns and to the other, to stay collaborative, even if there was an initial surge of anger.
And some of the costs of anger that you cite in Prescriptions Without Pills is that you wind up, if you are functioning from a place of anger, you wind up attacking the person instead of the problem. So quite frankly, the problem is still there.
Exactly. In a funny way, it makes you stupid. That is, unable to think and listen and take in new data and think of creative solutions. So yes, the problem is still there, or maybe gets worse. Because now, in addition to the original problem, there's bad feeling between you and the other people. Antagonism.
So holding on to anger, thinking that by using anger it actually makes you more powerful, is the last thing you want to do, because in fact anger sort of shortens your sight, shortens your creativity, closes off your openness. It just does all kinds of things that are quite frankly harmful.
Exactly. And also makes you less attractive. People tend to be nicer to people that they find attractive. They tend to make more problems for people that they don't like. And your anger is very off-putting.
And consuming, quite frankly.
Right. Anger can be consuming when it's geared toward getting what you want. It can also be consuming when the anger is in the form of anger at a past hurt. Holding on to resentment hurts you as much as the event itself did.
Interesting. You talk about addictions, and in the conversation about addictions, I believe you've included a conversation about infidelity.
Yes.
Talk about that very briefly, if you can.
Yes. So infidelity is a form of addiction. If two people are married, you would think they would be loyal to each other. If sexual feelings begin to arise in one of them toward a third person, those chemicals of sexual attraction are highly addictive. So over time, it becomes more and more difficult to let go of the third person because the chemistry of sex is just very potent, very addictive.
The folks who are listening who would like to learn more about, certainly about prescriptions without pills, and learn more about what you're doing, where your writings appear, where can you guide them to go?
Great. They can just Google prescriptions without pills. They can go to their local bookstore or onto Amazon. They can also go to the Prescriptions Without Pills website. That has videos and downloadable materials that can help you work on your own negative emotions. Best to use the website with the book because the book augments what's on the website. The website alone also, though, offers a lot of helpful information.
There is a huge amount of information at the website, and I would absolutely recommend that folks go to the website. Just give us the website address for the book one more time.
Prescriptionswithoutpills.com.
There you go.
Yes.
Dr. Susan Heitler.
Or they can Google my name, Susan Heitler, and I have blog posts in various places on the Internet that augment these ideas.
And if you would spell your name.
Heitler.
Okay.
Dr. Heitler.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Heitler, so much.
Thank you.
For joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Thank you for the work you continue to do. I completely appreciate all of your books, all of your works, and so much of your writing. Thank you very much.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. I'd like to offer a special thank you to Marcel Reed, who recommended Dr. Heitler to the Mind Talk audience. Mind Talk comes to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Community. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. But the best place to go is mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And again, Mind Talk programs are available to you on demand to listen as often and whenever you choose. And folks, please always remember, if it's unacceptable, and that is exactly what it is. Unacceptable. You take it.